Wine Country Live today, kicking off our candidate profile series for local elections in 2020. The first of those will be in March when supervisors will be voted on, and there are two contested races now in Napa County. One of those is in District 4, and today we're going to meet the challenger for that District 4 supervisor seat. Amber Manfrey is here with us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
Let's get acquainted. As I was saying to you off the air, when somebody is new on the political scene, we want to find out a little bit about them personally and background and experience and so forth. So tell us the Amber Manfrey story.
Sure. I was raised in Napa, and my family's been here quite a while. They moved here around 1905 and lived in town for a while, and then in the 1930s moved out to the country. So we live at the end of Soda Canyon Road, which is a very beautiful place. It's a very tight-knit community, which I really appreciated growing up in. And and Napa's just a great place to be. So I'm also a geographer. I make maps, and I study landscapes and people and how they interact. Let's see, what else? I've been focusing on how landscapes change over time for the last 15 years, working on natural resources management across California. I've had projects in Sonoma County, in Solano County, up and down the Central Valley, in the Sierras, and I've done quite a bit of work in Napa, too, looking at how our landscapes are changing, particularly in response to policy.
Well, that's a very meaty subject that we can get into as we talk. What about education and training and so forth? Where'd you go to school?
Oh, sure. Well, I went to Vichy Elementary, which was lovely, and I graduated from Vintage High School in 1995. I went to Sonoma State University, and I studied environmental studies there and communications. And I took about 10 years off, and I worked all kinds of different jobs. I worked at farmers markets. I worked at Roundtable Pizza. I worked at a community market in Santa Rosa, which is a natural food store with a very unique business model. It's worker run. So while I was there, even though I was only in my early 20s, I was able to progress to sitting on their board of directors and being a vice president and president of the board. And then I had a really wonderful job with the Laguna de Santa Rosa Foundation, which works on environmental restoration and management in the Santa Rosa Plain. And I had some good mentors there who suggested that I go to graduate school. And as somebody who does not have anyone in my whole family who's ever gone to graduate school, I had no idea what they were talking about. But I looked into it, and I decided it would be a good idea for me. And I went off to UC Davis and spent quite a few years there working on a master's and then a PhD in geography. And it was a wonderful experience. I found some excellent mentors, and it really taught me the power of mentorship to improve people's lives. And since then, I've been trying to give back as often as I can. The work that I did there was on Suisun Marsh, and I studied the history of that landscape going back to its formation 6,000 years ago, but with particular attention to the last 200 years, looking at the post-European contact period.
Interesting work. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, I was really lucky to have that project. Yeah. It was so, it just never got boring.
Mm-hmm. So have you always been interested in politics?
I think as somebody who comes from a blue-collar family, yes, I've always been interested in politics. And Napa itself, it's got different pressures affecting us where, we've seen a lot of rapid change over the last 30, 40 years. And it's a pretty interesting thing to follow. And the local decisions really do affect our lives, which I think is one of the reasons I'm running for supervisor. I see that there's a need for more attention to how locals are being affected by policy that's developed in our county.
Very good. Would you identify yourself as an environmentalist?
Sure, but I think first I would identify, pardon me, I think first I would identify myself as a scientist. And the reason I say that is I've spent a lot of years, I did spend a lot of years doing environmental activism, and then I went on to graduate school and learned how to analyze things from a more from a more objective kind of perspective. And what I found, there's a couple things really important about being a scientist. One is that I found that the answers, when you analyze the information that's out there, the data, are not always what you expect, and they're not always intuitive. Another thing is that science can be a really wonderful way to bring people together around difficult issues. So if you have a situation where people are fighting over, say, how to bring salmon back to a stream, when you take it out of the realm of being a conceptual argument and into the realm of being an argument over which methods work best, most people want to bring salmon back. They're not going to really argue over getting it done. But some people are going to say, I don't like the methods you're proposing. Now, if you study them and you can come up with something that's proven likely to work, you're going to get everybody on board and actually get to a solution. And there's been a lot of really great demonstrations of this around the state. Caltrout's been doing great work. Working at UC Davis, I was in a fish lab, so I saw this going on all the time. And I was like, wow, that really works. You know, and that's a little bit different from saying, I'm an environmentalist, you know, in people's minds, I think. So, you know, I do want to do good things for the environment, fully believe in it. You know, like I said, I grew up in rural Napa. I love the countryside. But the way we get there as a collaborative process needs to be based on real information that we get out of studies, I think.
Standing up for science used to be like, of course, and now in today's world, it's like, oh, science, really? Science? You believe in science?
I think it still has a lot of value.
Right. Let's hope most of us still feel that way.
Yeah.
So was there anything specific that precipitated you deciding to run for this supervisor seat?
Oh, gosh, yes. I'm interested in local issues, and I was going before the Board of Supervisors regarding a number of projects locally, mostly to do with permitting of wineries and winery event centers in rural areas, also having to do with it's kind of a saga, right? But like the later stages of Measure C, where the county was looking at adopting a water quality tree protection ordinance last May. So I was going in front of the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission, meeting with them outside of the boardroom one-on-one to explain issues to them from, I'm a credentialed professional individual. I'm explaining to them the science behind, you know, why I think certain policy decisions might be better for the community. And I was finding that what I was saying did not seem to be incorporated in the final outcomes of the policy, in a way that was meaningful. And that's really a concern to me. So that was one reason I considered running. I don't think I would have run just for that reason, though, because I have a wonderful job. Barry, I get to sit around in my pajamas and make maps all day. It's so fun. So I'm really lucky. But I also had people asking me to run and saying, please, you know, won't you run? You have a lot of relevant skills, and I think we need a different direction in leadership. And I was like, okay, you know, like, let me think about it. And after it became clear that everyone else who had been considering running was dropping out around last September, I was like, oh, I guess this is serious. Let's go.
Okay. That's a good story. We're talking with Amber Manfrey, who is challenging the District 4 supervisorial incumbent, Alfredo Pedroza. And from a purely practical perspective, in any community, challenging an incumbent is difficult. Unseating incumbents is difficult. It usually takes a combination of factors. In my experience, you have to raise a lot of money, have a bunch of endorsements, and usually you have to have an incumbent who's made some dramatic mistakes, mm-hmm. gotten caught in some problems. Not really the case with anyone locally, and it hasn't been for a long time. I've never seen like a scandal, you know, in Napa mm-hmm. that brought somebody down. How do you tackle that very difficult challenge of unseating an incumbent? And talk a little bit about endorsements, fundraising, and some of those practical matters.
Yeah, sure. I think it was a sign when people started asking me to run, and I wouldn't have run if it was just one or two people. It was kind of person after person, and I was like, wow, you know, there's a lot of support for this change. So that was kind of the first thing. It actually made it pretty easy to pull a team together on a volunteer basis so that we could start reaching out and pulling even more people into that team. At this point, I have probably close to 200 people volunteering on the campaign, which is incredible to me in this small community. And so that's a big part of this, is that I think people are concerned about the direction of things, and they do find me as a person, and I think as a scientist with the skills I have, to be a promising candidate. So that's the first thing, I think. And then there's just been a lot of community support. And when I'm out knocking on doors, I'm finding the same thing. People are frustrated with the direction of things locally. They think that perhaps we're not carefully considering the overall impacts of the level of permitting that we're doing for wineries and event centers, particularly in the Ag Preserve. They're concerned about their water supplies. They're really concerned about climate change. Most people are. And they don't really see measures being taken that are visible to address it. I mean, we've been sitting on the Climate Action Plan for over 10 years now, and now it's out of date. It probably wouldn't even be appropriate if we did adopt it. You know, that's that's not good planning. So there's a number of issues people are kind of coming out and saying, hey, you know, like, this candidate has the right approach, the approach I like, and I'm finding that support. I have been endorsed by the Growers Vintners for Responsible Agriculture, who I also worked for last year, producing a report about the potential impacts of the Water Quality Tree Protection Ordinance, so we could better understand how that actually played out on the ground. So they liked the work I did. I think they found it helpful to advance the discussion, and they saw that I had those kinds of skills, and then they chose to endorse me after I decided to run. So that was great. I've also been endorsed by Napa Vision 2050 and Protect Rural Napa, and I was a founding member of Protect Rural Napa, so I guess it's not surprising that they endorsed me. But that really is a wonderful group of mostly Soda Canyon Road residents who've really come together around development issues in rural areas and done some great work to protect our landscapes. You know, when you look up at those hills and you see open space, that's not an accident. That's the result of a lot of hard work from people over the last four decades, you know, and that work is ongoing in our community. What was the other question? Oh, fundraising. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've had some generous donations, but we're running a pretty lean campaign. But I think the thing is that we have a lot of interest from the community. So people are talking to each other. We're also doing a number of community forums coming up where you can see me and the other candidates side by side talking about issues. There's one on Wednesday. The Progressive Alliance Forum at 7:00 at the Napa Library. And there's a few more coming up too. Napa Vision 2050 is running one, and the League of Women Voters also.
Very good. And thanks for mentioning all those. We like our listeners to be informed and engaged. When you mention Napa Vision 2050, when you mention event centers around wineries and so forth, that phrase in itself, many people may respond to that saying, okay, this person is anti-wine business, anti-winery. There's a hashtag that circulates sometimes, blame the wineries. You may have seen that. How do you respond to that if I ask you, are you anti-wine business?
Oh, right. That's such an important question in this community. So I'm not anti-wine business. I'm not anti-vineyard. But I do think we need to look at cumulative impacts of what we're doing, because the traffic situation is pretty bad, and we're not necessarily building the housing we need to house workers close to the jobs they have, and it's contributing to that, and that's, of course, contributing to our carbon emissions, and that's not good either. So it's kind of, you get a little bit far ahead of yourself when you just permit winery after winery without looking at the cumulative effect on the community, and that is a real concern. You know, it's not that I don't think wineries are appropriate for our area. You know, that's great. That's our economic engine. But we're at the point where we have somewhere between 500 and 600, as I understand it, and there's no apparent slowing in the permitting. And, you know, at some point, nothing can grow forever. And, you know, maybe that's a hard discussion for some people to have, but it's an important discussion for a community. The other thing that I think is really important for people to understand is that there's a lot of vineyard expansion in the hills, and people have been pushing back against that because it affects our water supplies, because it affects habitats and biodiversity, and those aren't good impacts. And the thing is, though, that over the last 40 years, there has not been a substantial increase in the overall acreage of vineyard in Napa County. Even though we have all of this conflict with conversion of wildland to vineyard, and that's because we're urbanizing the valley floor almost as fast as we're converting the hillsides. And when you think about it that way, we're taking the best ag land we have, some of the best ag land in the world, and we're covering it with event centers, with increased production facilities for wine, and parking lots for all the workers and visitors. I'm not sure that's a good trade-off to be making from a planning perspective, and no one's talking about that because no one is thinking about it happening because they're not looking at the data. And that's kind of the difference with having a scientist who wants to look at where are things actually changing and how, and does that make sense?
Amber Manfrey is our guest. It's our first candidate profile segment for the current election season. Amber is challenging Alfredo Pedroza for the District 4 supervisor seat. We'll continue with the candidate profile and hear more and talk about other topics in just a couple of minutes. Back now with our candidate profile, segment two. We're talking today with Amber Manfrey, who is running for the District 4 supervisor seat, challenging the incumbent Alfredo Pedroza. Our candidate profile series is the way we begin our local coverage of elections, and we'll meet each candidate individually, and then later hope to have some debate format shows, some joint appearances. We'll see how that pans out as time goes by. So back to some specific questions. Again, Amber Manfrey, our guest right now. You made a couple of statements. I jotted down what you said just to go back and get into more detail. Policy decisions that are better for the community. You mentioned that as a phrase. You'd like mm-hmm. to see policy decisions that are better for the community. What do you mean by that? And are there some specific policy decisions that you have in mind?
Sure. So what I mean by that is policy decisions where, if there's a concept for a policy that's being developed and there's public input, that public input is seriously considered. And maybe even beyond that, that people making decisions not only hear and incorporate comments from the public, but that they perhaps even reach out and do stakeholder processes to make sure, especially for bigger decisions, that we're really addressing everybody's concerns. There's a lot of people who live here who don't necessarily, like they're busy working, they're busy with their day-to-day lives, and even though these policies do affect them, it's really hard to show up at a supervisor meeting or a planning commission meeting at 9 a.m. during working hours and wait for a half hour or 45 minutes or maybe much longer before you can make a 3-minute comment on something that's going to happen. I've done it quite a lot, and as a working age person, it takes a big bite out of your day. So that's the kind of thing where maybe we need to find other ways for people to be able to contribute to the planning process. As far as specific examples, I think probably the best example we have is going on right now. The Board of Supervisors has recently appointed themselves to be the Groundwater Sustainability Authority for the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act requirements that the Department of Water Resources has developed. And from everything that I've seen from the Department of Water Resources, who's managing SGMA at the county level, their intent was to have stakeholder groups made up of members of the community who are directly affected by groundwater decisions, being the people who made determinations and oversaw reporting about their groundwater supplies. However, in Napa County, the Board of Supervisors decided they would be the appropriate body to oversee our groundwater in the valley floor of Napa. And I have some concerns about this. One, because I really don't feel like it follows the spirit of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, but also because it means that now the Board of Supervisors is overseeing groundwater, and none of them are technical experts in groundwater or hydrology. And I question a process where they're going to be hiring a consultant to produce a report, and then they're going to oversee whether or not that report is adequate. It'll go on to DWR and they'll also oversee that. But I just really question that as a process where the intent of the law of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act was to have a real stakeholder group that would have included vintners, it would have included the cities, it would have included low-income people who may rely on groundwater in the area and residents who have wells that they're living on. So those people, I don't really see how they're going to have a meaningful voice with the process that's being implemented right now.
Mm-hmm. A couple of fundamental devil's advocate type questions, in the more general sense of growth and development. You mentioned some things in the first segment about how many wineries there are now, how many different things are going on the valley floor and development of the hillsides. Some people feel that there are enough limitations as it is. Property owners have a right to do what they want to do with their property, and that we rely on, as you said, wine industry is the economic engine. And if we're going to have jobs for our families as our kids grow up and want to live here, we need to keep going, keep growing in the industry. I guess the challenge in my mind is stopping something is drastic. Moratoriums are drastic. Intensely restricting permits can be very drastic for the economic side of things. Discuss that a little bit. Talk about how you get over that hump.
Sure. So for one thing, I want to just reiterate that I do understand that vineyards and wine production and tourism are a huge part of our economy, and I'm not opposed to them being a huge part of our economy. I think that's really important right now, and it has been, and it will be going into the future. We're also facing a climate crisis where we need to change a lot of the things we're doing to make sure that we're not further compromising our own future well-being. And with the way that we've been doing development, that really hasn't been taken into consideration in a meaningful way. So I think that's a good starting point to look at future developments through a lens of climate adaptation and through a lens of also of impacts on water supplies. That's kind of one common sense way of not overexploiting the resources that we have available. And then the other thing about that is that even with the current levels of projected change associated with CO2 emissions in the climate here in Napa Valley may not be as good for premium wine grapes going forward. And, certainly in 50 years or 100 years, it may be that our climate is a lot more like the climate of Redding, which is not a premium wine growing region. And we're going to have to make some kind of transition to deal with that. Now, we can try to stave it off as long as we can by doing things like planting hedgerows and managing our crops with dry farming techniques where the water tables are high enough. We can make sure the water tables are high enough to do that if we're managing our groundwater well. And there's a number of other things that we can do on our farms. And I would certainly advocate that to address climate change. However, in the long term, I think that as a community, we really need to focus on economic diversity and building, just augmenting our overall economic diversity so that we have other businesses that are also part of our economic engine that are meaningful contributors to our economy. And I think that would be good for locals on a number of levels. It would mean better jobs with career ladders more commonly. I've struggled to find consistent, good-paying work in Napa as a younger person. It was really, really hard to come back. Even though I wanted to, I couldn't. I ended up staying in Santa Rosa because there were no good jobs here. And there it was really easy because it's a very diverse economy. There's lots of different things you can be doing. There's a few things about that that I'm kind of rambling here, I think that we need to think about these things a little more comprehensively, and also for how they affect families and people who are looking to, to put it simply, just to better their lives and better themselves. And it's such a laser focus on the wine industry. And even though I know it's very important, I think we need to broaden our view a little bit here.
Let's talk about housing specifically. You touched on that briefly. There's no question that we're having a crisis of availability and affordability both in many places like Napa. What could you do as a county supervisor to impact that housing problem?
Housing is on everybody's mind. I realize it's one of the biggest concerns for people. And it's critically important. So for the supervisors, they're overseeing the county area, which is the ag preserve, the ag watershed, and some other zones. They don't directly oversee what happens in the cities. They can partner, they can influence some, but the cities are overseeing what's happening inside city limits. And inside city limits is where most new housing is going to go because the ag preserve is basically off limits, and the ag watersheds are Not a great place to build because of their locations are mostly remote, and then you're increasing your carbon emissions to travel to and from. It gets complicated. So if you're going to so I'm in support of smart growth principles where we're densifying our existing cities and building more bike connectivity, pedestrian friendly spaces, and that kind of thing. So for the county to be a better partner to cities to get that kind of building done, the county can find ways to channel funding from projects that are built in county areas to the cities to help offset the costs for developers to do low-income housing and alternative-style developments, maybe co-housing, you know, things that allow for a little bit denser lifestyles and maybe building up a little bit more. I'm not saying 10 stories, but if we can have a 5-story Archer Hotel, maybe we can have some other tall things that help us have more affordable housing for everybody and change our landscape a little bit. And another thing the county can do is it can look at the array of properties that it owns and look at what might be good trade-offs for selling certain properties to generate funds to help cities build low-income housing. And another thing that I should mention while we're on housing is farm worker housing is a big concern. And up and down the valley, you know, there's thousands of people working, especially during harvest. There's lots of people here. But there's a lot of workers who stay. They don't necessarily just move through seasonally. So, and we've done a lot of work in the community and some good work to house farm workers in more dormitory style housing, but we haven't done a lot for families or as much as we need to, I think. I think there's families style housing that's needed out for farm workers, and that's something the county can do or can support developers doing in the ag watershed and the ag preserve.
Let's talk a little about Measure C. There was a reference to it earlier, but we didn't really get into how you felt about Measure C. Did you support that measure when it was on the ballot? And the follow-up question is, what is your thinking about what comes next from that? There's been this conversation since that, but we're still not resolved. There's no resolution.
Yeah, so Measure C was an initiative that the goal of which was, it was on the ballot, and the goal of it was to preserve woodlands ostensibly for the benefit of our watersheds. And I do support the preservation of woodlands for climate adaptation across Napa County. I overall support Measure C, but when I actually looked at it from an analysis perspective, what I found was that our water supply watersheds, so Kimball Reservoir, Bell Canyon, Conn, Hennessy Reservoir, and Rector and Milliken and Madigan, those are water supply watersheds in Napa County, by and large are not covered by trees. And so while it's always a good thing to save our forests, you know, just for so many different reasons, for biodiversity, for the health of watersheds that are downstream of the forests, our actual drinking water supplies come from areas that are predominantly covered by chaparral and grassland. And so if you just save trees, you're actually not doing a whole lot to save our water supplies. And that was really surprising to me because it is so easy to assume that up in the hills they're covered by forests. But a lot of our eastern hills are actually covered by things that aren't forest. And so I think that we actually need to look at, if our goal is to protect water supplies, then we need to go, you know, storing carbon is really important, and storing carbon should be a goal, and to do that we should save trees. But if we're going to be protecting our water supplies, trees alone won't do it. We also need to look at chaparral and grasslands, which both of which store more carbon than vineyards do. And again, it's just thinking about these things from more of a systemic perspective and thinking about what do we actually have to do, the heavy lifting to get climate change adaptation done and protect our biodiversity and that kind of thing.
So I was curious to ask a question. This is kind of not an easy question to ask, I guess, because it doesn't form into a question very well. But when you talk to people from Europe, particularly vineyardists, people who know the wine business in Europe, they look at us and say, why do you plant all your vines down on the flat ground? You should be planting them up on the hills like we do in Italy and France and Switzerland, wherever it might be, Germany. What do you think about that? I mean, they have successfully done that for decades and centuries in many places, and you don't really hear about environmental degradation I don't hear about it. I don't know that it doesn't exist. But you follow my logic?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that as a science-y person?
As a science-y person. Well, this is something I might want to research a little more before I make definitive statements. But I do understand that we have different soil types, that they're maybe a little bit looser, and we may have more susceptibility to erosion here. So that's the first question I would have, you know, if I went to research it more, is are we looking at, you know, the same thing? And the other thing is that our water supply systems are probably a little bit different. I know that they rely on dams throughout Europe also, but I don't think they're at the scale that we're on here. Those would be my questions. Mm-hmm. I'd be looking at soil types, at precipitation patterns, and how the water system actually functions for people to get clean water and a reliable supply of it.
Mm-hmm. Can erosion be controlled if hillside development is allowed? I mean, from a science perspective, because you're worried about the water supply.
Yeah, definitely it can. And there's a lot of adaptation measures that we can do to control it. But I think the first thing would be adequate enforcement of the development that we do have. There's been, as I mentioned, I live out on Upper Soda Canyon in the Rector Plateau. It's had a lot of acreage converted to vineyards. And I've definitely seen cases where erosion control permits aren't being followed, where the rules about stream setbacks aren't being followed. And it can be very, very difficult to get the county to respond to complaints about permit violations. And I think that's a troubling thing. And that's not always even the landowner. A lot of times it's just the contractor who they've hired to do the work will come up and they won't be following the rules. So it's kind of this downstream thing. But ultimately, of course, the person who hired the work is responsible and I think should be held accountable when they're affecting our water supplies. Rector Watershed's been offline a couple times in the past because their sand filters have gotten clogged, which happens when there's a lot of sediment in the reservoir, and there's no monitoring upstream. So I think that's another issue, is that we should be monitoring what's going on so we know where the problems are coming from so we can start addressing them when we have them.
Very good. We've been talking here with Amber Manfrey, who is a candidate for supervisor in Napa County. She's running in District 4 as a challenger. And I'd like to give you a minute to summarize and make a statement, close out, and why people you think should vote for you.
Sure. So thank you for listening today. It was great to talk to you all. I hope you'll consider voting for me. I come from a science background and also from the background of being a long-term Napa resident. I care a lot about this place, and I want to find decisions that work for us as locals now and long into the future. I am a listener, I'm a lifelong learner, and I love talking about this stuff. So please reach out to me. You can get a hold of me through our website, www.ambermanfreyforsupervisor2020.com. And thank you for listening. Let's put locals first.
Thank you for your time today. It's good to get acquainted. We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure. And that's going to be a wrap for today's Wine Country Live.